Hello, and welcome to Off the Cuff. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and on this program, every week, we are going to bring you a fascinating guest, where we are going to discuss the economy, energy, or the environment, informally and without a script. Welcome, everyone, to this Off the Cuff. It is Wednesday, March 6th, 2019. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today, I'm going solo. So what we're going to do here today is we're going to talk about what's been on my mind. I mean, you know, the whole point of Off the Cuff is off the cuff. There's nothing really scripted here. And I've maybe gone off the reservation a tiny bit because I actually did pull some material and prepare a little bit more than usual for this one. And what's really been catching me of late has been more of the emotional aspects of what's been going on out in the world and the ways in which people are either coping or not coping. And you might have heard the data recently that in the United States, a tragic statistic came forward, which is that the rates of suicide are up quite a bit. In 2017, I think, is the last year of the data set. So who knows where 2018 will come in. But suicide is up, addictions are up, and opiate use is up, and things like that. And again, these are all just measures of people being deeply, deeply unhappy, unable to cope. They are, in a way, as we've discussed, demoralized. Now, I'm going to get into that more in a bit, because it's such an important concept. And I want to tell you what I'm seeing out there right now. So before we dive into all that, let me just say that my own state has been rather annoyed a lot lately by what's been going on out in the markets, as the authorities, they're not even pretending anymore. They're not even trying to hide it. There was an article in Bloomberg today that, according to administration sources, Donald Trump is hoping to get a China trade deal so the markets can power higher. So you have a president who's openly day trading the market and hoping that he can horse whip it a little higher. It's a really unseemly thing. And I don't want to say that I think Trump would be alone in any presidency out there. I don't think Hillary would have been any different. I doubt even that Bernie will be any different. That the people who get in power, they want the systems that exist out there, be those the market-based systems or the focus groups that might be run or whatever the press is saying. They want to be loved, right? They want that positive confirmation that their presence and their actions are headed in the right direction. And of course, it's taken without any question ever that it's always a good thing when the stock market goes up, right? And of course, you know, you would share that if you had a large portfolio and you had your tertiary wealth wrapped up in the portfolio values, and somehow you were wrapped up with that. Of course, it feels good to watch your value holdings go up. But as we've been talking about, until and unless we had other data come out this week, until and unless the central banks really resume printing, we thought the markets were in pretty tough shape back in December, and they were. And of course, the central banks came out and they until and unless all over the place. They printed like crazy, $500 billion of new liquidity injected in December and early January. Mostly China, but it came from other sources and places as well. And not even a half a day seems to go by anymore without the Federal Reserve coming out, trotting out some official going, well, you know, if things got worse at any point, we would be open to exploring new options, which is all wink, wink, code speak for, you know, do whatever it takes to get the markets to go higher. You can feel the desperation, right? They are so desperate to get the markets to go higher is how it comes off. But I actually think there's something under that, which is they're even more desperately afraid of what happens if the markets get rolling to the downside. And that's because they've created fraudulent Franken markets. It's because they've really done something that was super duper ill-advised. It's because they've, in their attempts to, you know, create market stability, which is code speak for have financial asset prices go higher. What they've really done is they've driven one of the largest wealth gaps in the world, and that's starting to spill over sociologically and politically. And so I think they're a little bit afraid of what will happen if their last 10 years is revealed to have done nothing for the common person,
done everything for this super wealthy person. And now it's all going to fall apart anyway, because guess what? Credit bubbles are not real. They're chimeras. They are illusions. They are mirages. They are anything but real. And the reason for that, it's not hard. Like, you know, they just recently said, well, you know, the United States economy, Trump tweeted this. He was all excited. It grew 3%. Haha. You know, well, the U.S. government deficit spent a little over 6% in that year. Is it really 3% growth if you're 6% deeper, you know, due to all the debt you've taken on? You know, it just doesn't really work out that way. And so, yeah, you can create the appearance of a big party if you put it all in your credit card. You can spend the future. You can do all kinds of really dumb stuff. But ultimately, unless you're willing to believe that money is of no real matter anymore and that the authorities can do whatever they want without any consequences, unless you believe that, there will be consequences. And so we're tracking here at Peak Prosperity, and what I'm looking at on a daily basis, yes, I watch the markets get rescued on a daily basis. Someone's in there monkeying around with it. Is it the PPT? Is it Ben Bernanke working with Citadel? Is it all the central banks? Is it none of them? I don't really care. But what I see are markets that are behaving really deeply illogically, often without any connection to any sense of fundamentals. They're being horsewhipped higher, and this is a repeat of 2016. Remember, now everything was similarly falling apart. I was given warnings again in 2016. Yeah, the markets all rolled over and we had the dollar spiking and we had emerging markets in bear territory. All kinds of crazy stuff was happening. And what happened really was the central banks horsewhipped that near-dead patient back to life and got it back on the track for one more lap. And I think they're thinking they can do that again. And that's really where we're at right now. You know, can the central banks just go ahead and print and print and print and print and print and somehow get this patient to come back to life? Well, I don't think so. Maybe, but, you know, on a weighted balance, I think they've got about a 10% chance of success here, 90% chance of failure. A lot of reasons for that, right? First, the expansion is really long in the tooth. These things just run out of energy for other reasons. Two, a lot of really stupid malinvestments were made. And, you know, corporations are in record levels of debt. We've got student debts at all-time highs. We've got credit card debt at all-time highs. We've got auto debt at all-time highs. That's in the United States. Canada, they have the highest levels of debt to disposable income ever in their country's data series. And their real estate markets are already rolling over and pretty substantially. We've got Australia's markets rolling over. We've got all sorts of signs from across the global environment, including export statistics from South Korea, which is usually a pretty good bellwether for where the global economy is going. As goes their exports, goes the world economy, is how that usually plays out. We see a pretty steep collapse in chip. These are microprocessor chips. Not potato chips. The microprocessor chips have fallen off a cliff here in the past few months. They're a very sensitive canary in this coal mine as well. Looking at the bulk dry, the Cape size shipping rates and just collapsing, and as well orders, new orders for trucks in the United States. These are the big trucks that haul things. Pretty much in a very, very severe retreat. On and on and on. So we see all of that stuff, and those are the real things that are going on, and the central banks, bless their hearts, think they can just cram it one more time higher, and so we have to ask, in service of what? Well, growth, right? Isn't that what this is all about? We have to have more growth. Well, is it one more round of growth? Is it perpetual growth? Nobody has a plan for this, and this is really starting to spook the herd. There are a lot of people out there right now who get it, that something is really wrong. Yeah, you know, I talk about the yellow vests and how there's a whole rising sense among the people that they've really been shafted. And if you listen to some of the yellow vest protesters, they're talking about the role of banks, of the usury that's involved in banking, the deeply structural unfair things that happen as the so-called neoliberal capitalists, which aren't capitalists, by the way, it's just totally not capitalism, something else that involves subsidies for the rich, barriers to entry, regulatory morass that really favors the big over the small, banking policies that favor the big over the small, on and on and on. The people of France get it. And we're seeing this populism rise all over the place. But what's really been fascinating is to notice what's happening in the younger people. So there is a Reddit is a very popular website which aggregates a lot of information, has lots of communities, in fact, sub-communities, and they're called sub-Reddits. And so we'll just call them subs for now. There's a sub over there on Reddit, which is the Collapse sub. And it's got about 100,000 subscribers to it. And so people just post various sort of collapsey sort of headlines and news articles, and then other people comment on them. And so I just wanted to share with you a couple things that I found yesterday on there. And this is just very typical. There's lots of this conversation going on all over the place. Here's one where somebody started a whole thread, and the question being posed out by a young person was, is it logical to go to college when you know the collapse is coming one day? That's a fair question. I'm raising this because I want you to know how young people are starting to view this, because revolutions never start at the center, right? They always start from the outside in, and they almost always start with the young. Older people tend to have too much invested in the way things are to sort of revolt against it. It's usually incumbent on those who have no skin in the game or low skin in the game, who are being asked to shoulder some unfair burden. They'll step up and revolt. So that was an interesting one. And then here was another one. I'm going to read you more of this because this was written by an 18-year-old, and they just had a little rant that they came out with. And so it reads like this, quote, "Why did I have to be born in such a time where I'll see horrid global atrocities, the likes of which have never been seen on this earth? I'm mad that no one in human history ever needed to see the global picture, and we're only able to see it once it's too late and we're already on the path of almost complete annihilation. I'm mad because of how pointless my day-to-day life as an 18-year-old is. People all around this sub seem almost surprised how insanely ill much of our generation is, but it's because we've been born into a shitty era where we have no control over our present or future survival. I go to high school and college and get overworked to doing all kinds of useless busy work in the hope that I can go to college for a few more miserable years and then what? Join the rat race? What exactly do I have to look forward to?" So this goes on, and this rant basically comes down with to this conclusion at the end, where he says, and pardon the French, but the vernacular is important here. Quote, he says, "Fuck industrial society. It maximizes profits and minimizes happiness of the 99%, so the 1% can bask in rampant hedonism and amass enough shit to weather the storm of the lower class demanding clean water and a place to sleep. I'm just so incredibly fucking done. I can't remember the last time I felt happy. Consumerism is not a happy lifestyle and not even the least bit sustainable." End quote. So this is a point of view I'm coming across a lot, and it's really starting to show up in the younger people in particular, because they don't have a sense of hopefulness and they don't really have a story they can believe in. And they don't have a narrative that makes sense here. And by the way, the consumer narrative, increasingly people are getting it. They're saying this is broken. At first, it's not even all that fulfilling in the first place. But second of all, it doesn't have a future. So if you hold those two views as a young person, wow, it must be hard to figure out how you're going to study, 14 hours a day so that you can participate in that system. You know, I just have to... I'm recalling that quote by Jay Krishnamurti, which says, "It's no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society." It isn't. And that's really what society is asking, especially the young people. It's like, come on, get well adjusted, take on more student debt, you'll get a job, all of that, right? And lurking under that, there's a quote that I put in a piece on, I think it was in a piece titled The End of Growth. It might have been Our Horrible Future. I can't remember. One of those two. And it was a Marcus Aurelius quote where he said, "It is not death man should fear, but he should fear never beginning to live." And I think that's a lot of what our consumer culture is asking of us. It's like to never actually live, right? Are you too happy? Got a pill for that. We can dial you back. A little depressed? We got a pill for that. We can dial you up. We want you in this really comfortable band. And oh, by the way, you know, you can't talk about anything important. You'll be shamed for that. Sports, your job, stuff like that. But, you know, nothing beyond that. And tons and tons of support for, you know, if you want a Netflix binge, we got a lot of support for wasting your time that way. But if you really want to get passionate about something, or you want to dare show the ways in which, or point out the ways in which the system isn't working for you, we're going to label that as some sort of a sickness. You know, I can't even tell you how many pop psychology articles I've read in places like BuzzFeed and Psychology Today that have been attempting to paint conspiracy theorists as somehow mentally defective. Not unlike what the Soviets did back in the Soviet era, where the Politburo and party apparatchiks would say that if you didn't believe in the communist system, you were mentally defective and off to Siberia you went, you know? When in fact, many of the people who are so-called conspiracy theorists are just asking questions. They're saying, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense to me. For instance, here's something that never made sense to me, that so much time was spent by the entire media on the deplorable sexual antics of Donald Trump. Endless hours. And I can't remember reading one thing about Hillary's husband, Bill, who took 26 trips, five without his Secret Service detail, on a plane owned by Jeffrey Epstein, the convicted pedophile, who's that plane was known as the Lolita Express. A lot of famous people went on that. He just got a really super sweetheart deal, you know, and that's now falling apart. A very interesting story there. The Miami Herald's done a great job detailing that. And it turns out that the super wealthy and well-connected protect themselves all the time from really horrid behaviors, really horrid stuff. But if you ask questions about that, right, if you poked into that 2 or 3 years ago and asked those sorts of questions and made those sorts of observations, out they trot the are you one of those conspiracy theorists? No, there's a flight manifest. Bill Clinton's name's on it 26 times. I think somebody ought to be asking him some questions about that, right? If it's a relevant thing to ask about our leaders, then it's a relevant thing, or it's not. But the point here is that young people are starting to get what a raw deal this whole piece is to step into this industrial society that's all about maximizing profits, minimizing happiness, and selling you solutions to make you unhappy and then fix that unhappiness, right? So one way that that's expressed lately, which I'm really very pleased with, and I love the energy that's coming behind it, is that students all over the world now, but it really began in Europe, actually began with a 16-year-old girl in Sweden, Greta Thunberg. But students all over Europe, that's in the UK and Germany and Belgium, elsewhere, they walked out of schools to make their voices heard over climate change. And in Belgium, there have been strikes by thousands of students for at least 4 consecutive weeks now, with one now famous protest sign reading, it was addressed to the politicians and policymakers looking out of their windows. And that protest sign read, "I'll do my homework when you do yours." Right. So these are young people, you know, saying, I don't want to participate in this. Why am I going to participate in school? Why should I study? For what? That means that there's some future that you're asking me to engage with. And the student, I think, nailed it by saying, I'll hold up my end of the bargain if you hold up yours. But until that point in time, we're kind of on strike here. And I think speaking for many of them, mentioning this 16-year-old Greta Thunberg from Sweden, a first stage to school strike for climate in front of parliament, the Swedish parliament, in August, all by herself, by the way, handing out flyers with messages like, "You grown-ups don't give a shit about my future." And she told the Davos straight up a couple of things. One, she said, "I want you to panic," right? Because somebody said, "Oh, are you asking people to panic?" She said, "Yeah, I want you to panic." And she also said, straight up, she said, "Some people, some companies, some decision makers in particular have known exactly what priceless values they have been sacrificing to continue making unimaginable amounts of money. And I think many of you here today belong to that group of people." So she called them right out on the carpet, right to their faces, truth to power, youth to age, saying that these people really lack values. And of course, that's true. And I think each of us probably has ways in which we're participating in a system that is being destructive. And I don't think any of us are clean and pure, but the greed of the Davos set, of the powers that be, of the neoliberal economists and all of their sycophants, it's just been astonishing to live in this new gilded age and to watch all of this come thundering forward. I've been just ruthless in my condemnation of the Federal Reserve, and now I'll direct my ire at Jay Powell because he's the current chairman of that. But boy, I hated Yellen, really hated Bernanke. Really, I think Greenspan, just a miserable human being. But they just happen to be the figureheads of an organization that is there to take from the many and give to the few. That's what the Federal Reserve is. They're a reverse Robin Hood organization. I think we need to characterize them correctly before we can move on. I think we need to understand what the dimensions of the problem set really is and have agreement around that before we can even begin to start talking about what the solutions might be. So I think it's good that these students are coming forward and saying, hey, we need a voice in this, and we need to know that we have a future we can believe in. And one last quote from Greta I thought was wonderful. She said, I think enough people have realized just how absurd the situation is. We are in the middle of the biggest crisis in human history, and basically nothing is being done to prevent it. I think what we are seeing is the beginning of great change that is very hopeful. So I certainly hope that's true, and I would share that with her, that this is really coming forward, and it's been a long time. It's been a long time. I was a much younger man when I first began this job, and that I'm speaking to you from this seat here in my basement, where what I've been doing is doing everything I can, along with Adam Taggart and our crew, to spread the word. And lots of people are spreading the word, and this will pass through, I think, the usual stages of truth, courtesy of Arthur Schopenhauer. First, it will be ignored, then it will be ridiculed, and then it will be accepted as self-evident. I think he's missing a step in there. There's a point at which it's violently opposed and all of that, but that goes well beyond, you know, that ridicule and whatever else he was talking about. But it's changing. People are getting it. And whether it's, you know, one of the things I've said waggishly in the past was that if you don't like Donald Trump, you're going to hate the next person, right? In the sense that we're going to get more and more and more extreme individuals voted into power as the titular heads, as the figurative representatives, as if the president of 320 million people could really do much. Given the confines of the rules that exist in Rules for Rulers, which is that the keys to power require you to keep a big pyramid of people under you happy. And if you don't keep them happy, out you go. So I think we're going to start electing in wilder and wilder people. We might get this modern monetary theory, the MMT thing in. We might get more socialism. It might be more fascism. It's going to swing around a bit. And part of the reason I don't have a lot of hope in putting a new person in charge or power or trying out a crazy new monetary idea is because none of them are rooted in the actual cause. They're directed at the symptoms, right? So sure, you know, culturally and socially, we could fix some things with laws and tweaks and things like that. Maybe, you know, tweak some tax rates and stuff like that. But ultimately, none of that matters if underneath all of that, we find we have ruined ecosystems, or we have a dwindling net energy per capita that just doesn't allow us to do what we used to do in the ways we used to do it. So, you know, we need to be a little bit more nimble. We need to be able to see the future for what it is. We need to understand what that basic strategy is, right? What's a strategy? It's a vision and it's resources. Where are we going? What do we have to get there, right? That's all it is. And so if we had a comprehensive strategy for the world right now, we would add up all the fossil fuels that are left. We would look at the trajectory of population going forward. We would ask some really important questions about, where would we like to be in 10, 20, 30 years when, not if, but when, fossil fuels have dwindled to this level, or the atmosphere has baked this much, or the ocean has acidified that far, or you know, the aquifers have been drawn down this far. These are basic questions. We ought to be asking them. We should be answering them. The kids are coming forward saying, doesn't look to us like you adults have a plan, right? And they don't. The adults don't have a plan. The adults, if I can use that term with double quotes around it, the adults in charge seem to care mostly about stuff that looks, feels, and tastes fairly sociopathic, if not psychopathic. It's about death and destruction. You know, Trump oversaw one of the largest increases ever in the U.S. defense budget. Absolutely the largest in nominal dollar terms. A $70 billion increase just like that. Nobody said boo. 96 U.S. senators from both sides of the aisle signed right off on that and said, yeah, that's who we are, right? Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman out of Hawaii, has come forward, and she has a very, 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 what I would call kind of middle to left of center Democratic platform with one exception. She talks about peace over hate. She talks about needing to end the war machine. And oh my God, the Democrats, the progressives, and the media in general have gone absolutely out of their way to demonize this woman because she holds that one view, right? I think if Tulsi's revealed anything to me, it's the extent to which there's no daylight between the two parties, such as they are right now, when it comes to war, right? So Venezuela comes up and all of a sudden, you know, everybody's on board with this idea that Maduro's a really bad leader and he needs to go. I'll agree with the first part. He's a pretty bad leader. I disagree with the second part that the United States has any business in regime change, overthrowing somebody. You know, this whole idea where Pompeo came out and said, the children of Venezuela are really suffering, and this is what we need to do. And I vomit in my mouth when he says stuff like that, because this is a man who didn't care at all when he was part of the sanctions crew that was ramming sanctions on Iraq, where 500,000 children died under starvation. He said nothing about the children of Yemen who are starving to death right now. But all of a sudden, when it comes to Venezuelan children, they're the most important children in the world. And that's just, if people would just come out and say what's up, right? If Pompeo came out and said, look, Venezuela is really important. They have the second, if not the first largest known oil reserves on the face of the planet. China and Russia have been making really strong inroads in there, and they've been doing it in this really underhanded way. They've been forging relationships and making investments, and we think that's wrong. So what we want to do is we want to break the country, shatter it, and in that resulting chaos, we think that there's room for our banking, financial, and oil executives to get in there and to make inroads. But we don't want to have to compete with the Chinese and the Russians head to head because, gosh, then we're up against, like, yeah, you have to use diplomacy, and then you actually, you know, might have to pay a fair price, you know, win a bidding war, stuff like that. That's not how we roll, right? If you said that, now it'd be honest, you know, and we could have a conversation over whether that makes sense or not, and that's where we want to go. At any rate, I want to get back to what these kids have been saying, in particular, you know, these distressed young people who are really coming forward with expressions of saying, I feel depressed and I don't know what to do about it. And the truth is, they're not depressed. They're demoralized. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to read a bit from this article that I've posted a couple of times, but it made a huge impact on me. And I want to keep returning to it because I think it's got lessons for everybody listening to this, especially if you are somebody who's going to be in a position, and we all will, by the way, going to be in a position of needing to help a young person carry the weight, help them figure out what they're going to do, help ourselves figure out how we're going to maintain our even keel and continue to move forward with purpose and meaning and dignity as things become more and more chaotic over time. So this article is The Demoralized Mind, came out in April 2016. It was written by John Schumacher, who's a retired psychology academic living in Christchurch, New Zealand. And so he starts, quote, "Our descent into the age of depression seems unstoppable. 3 decades ago, the average age for the first onset of depression was 30. Today, it's 14. Researchers such as Stephen Izzard at Duke University point out that the rate of depression in Western industrialized societies is doubling with each successive generational cohort. At this pace, over 50% of our younger generation aged 18 to 29 will succumb to it by middle age. Extrapolating one generation further, we arrive at the dire conclusion that virtually everyone will fall prey to depression. Well, that's what happens if you're doubling and you get to that 50% mark. Who knows if it's going to be that dire, but you know, the point's made that in many traditional cultures, they didn't even have a word for depression. They lacked it entirely. And so the Western consumer culture is depression prone for some reason, and it's increasing, right? So again, you know, if you're want to take your big foam finger off that says we're number one on it, just take that off for a second and back up and ask some questions about how fit, how healthy, how actualized, how full of meaning and purpose are the lives of our citizens. You might come to the conclusion that there's a little room for improvement in this story somewhere. So that was startling to me. 50% of our young generation are going to succumb to this thing called depression. But he then goes on to make the point, quote, he says, but depression is so much a part of our vocabulary that the word itself has come to describe mental states that should be understood differently. In fact, when people with a diagnosis of depression are examined more closely, the majority do not actually fit that diagnosis. In the largest study of its kind, at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, they sampled over 5,600 cases and found that only 38% of them met the criteria for depression. Contributing to the confusion is the equally insidious epidemic of demoralization that also afflicts modern culture. Since it shares some symptoms with depression, demoralization tends to be mislabeled and treated as if it were depression. A major reason for the poor 28% success rate of antidepressant drugs is that a high percentage of depression cases are actually demoralization, a condition unresponsive to drugs. So here we are with this really important idea that the ennui, the spiritual depression that people seem to be experiencing is not true depression, which depression is either chemical in nature or situational. If it's chemical, it's very responsive to drugs. You give the drugs hopefully for a short period of time. That condition, that chemical imbalance lifts and the person can carry on. Or it's situational, right? My dad died, my dog got run over, I lost my job, I've been divorced, something happened, and you can resolve that situation and then come back. But demoralization, it's stickier than that. It tends to settle in, and it's much, much harder to root out, particularly if the seed of that demoralization is germinated in your culture itself. All right, so he makes great points in this. Continuing on, quote, in the past, our understanding of demoralization was limited to specific extreme situations, such as debilitating physical injury, terminal illness, prisoner of war camps, or anti-morale military tactics. But there is also a cultural variety that can, that can express itself more subtly and develop behind the scenes of normal everyday life under pathological cultural conditions, such as we have today. This culturally generated demoralization is nearly impossible to avoid for the modern consumer. Now we're getting down to the end quote, obviously. Now we're getting down to the core of it. This is really an indictment of the consumer culture. We know everything about selling stuff to ourselves and creating needs and then satisfying those needs and wants with consumer goods. The marketers these days are using really powerful techniques that are really born in a lot of science and behavioral psychology and neuro-linguistic programming and all sorts of subliminal advertising and on and on and on. And they've got us by the short ones with these little smartphones. I mean, I have mine with me all the time, and it's got games on there and little reward systems and receiving texts and getting emails back and all that, which hitting the dopamine centers. And boy, these things are really astonishingly good at keeping attention. But what they're really there to do is to create a condition where the owner of this device is now more susceptible. to parting with their money. They're great sales devices. I mean, you know the number of people who have, and sorry if you're one of them, who has an Alexa device in their home. You have a device in your home listening and figuring out what your needs and wants are, which could be useful. Could be useful. If my shoe breaks and suddenly new shoes showed up, that'd be wonderful. But it's really there to be undertaking a scientific decomposition of you and your family to figure out more about you specifically and people generally. And they're getting better and better at this stuff. And it's really remarkable science, but it's maybe not really an uplifting practice that we can all engage in. So this is this next paragraph. This is the heart of this article for me. I love this one. I want to share it now and then talk about it, because I think this gets to first, you know, those people who are the 18-year-old who was feeling really lost in this particular culture of consumerism, and secondarily, why there's so much energy in the young people who are beginning to rise up, and possibly as well in the French yellow vest as well, but in the young students who are striking. I think it's contained in this paragraph here. Quote, rather than a depressive disorder, demoralization is a type of existential disorder associated with the breakdown of a person's cognitive map. It is an overarching psycho-spiritual crisis in which victims feel generally disoriented and unable to locate meaning, purpose, or sources of need fulfillment. The world loses its credibility, and former beliefs and convictions dissolve into doubt, uncertainty, and loss of direction. Frustration, anger, and bitterness are usual accompaniments, as well as an underlying sense of being part of a lost cause or losing battle. The label existential depression is not appropriate, since, unlike most forms of depression, demoralization is a realistic response to the circumstances impinging on the person's life. End quote. That gets me, because there's so much in this one paragraph. I'm just going to step through it, the parts that really caught me. This idea that there's a breakdown of the person's cognitive map leading to this larger sort of psycho-spiritual crisis. That's really what we're facing here. You know, so if your cognitive map says, hey, go to school, get good grades, you'll get a job, and here's this whole story. That's your cognitive map. Okay, I'm 16 now. I'll be 18 by the time I'm 21. Here's when I plan to be married. You know, all the way on out, you have this cognitive map that maybe takes you out to retirement, right? Well, if you can't map that against reality, where you say, wait, but I have all this data that says there might not be any future at all. That's a profound breakdown in your cognitive map. And if your whole existence has been built around the structuring of that cognitive map, trust me, breaking that thing apart, shaking it down to its foundations and rebuilding it, really hard work. Nature, for whatever reason, has wired us to resist that very strongly. It often takes people hitting a really painful moment in life to begin to really reorient their and rebuild their cognitive map, the larger scaffolding that they hang their experiences on. But this is what the young people are fundamentally saying. They're saying this cognitive map, this cultural map that you've been giving me, older folks, or my larger culture, it doesn't map with my experience. It doesn't map with what I'm reading. It doesn't maybe map with what I'm feeling in my heart. Right. If you're at all sensitive and open, you know, on some level, that the web strands of life are breaking. Right. I know it because when I come out now in the morning after my porch light's been on all night, there aren't scary, wonderful insects plastered up against the screen door. It's almost empty now. Right. That's leads to that existential dread. But I'm recording that on some level. I am experiencing that. One does not simply wipe out the strands of life into which you are fully evolved and wired in. One does not simply do that without creating some form of psycho-spiritual crisis, I believe. That's certainly how I register it. So I like that. And as a descriptor, I mean, I don't like it as a process, but I like this as a descriptor because it means then he talks about how the victims feel generally disoriented and unable to locate meaning. Right. It's like it's a really, like, I think, you know, anytime you are coming out of adolescence, a lot of big questions like, who am I? What do I do? And a lot of trial and error. Well, I don't really like, you know, this kind of work, and I hate that, and I'm not as good with people as I thought, but I'm better at this, or whatever. That, you know, there's some trial and error. That's part of the process. But when you lose your cognitive map, that general disorientation level, that leaves you unable to locate meaning. Oh, what happens when people are unable to locate meaning? Well, that's painful. Well, how do we get past pain? Well, one way is you can anesthetize yourself. You can numb yourself out. Opioids are great for that. If it gets really bad, you do the big checkout. So when we look at the suicide and the drug use data, it makes sense to me. Those are not things we should be looking at and saying, well, that's terrible and this is awful, and what we need to do is treat those things. If what's leading to them in the first place is the fact that the people who are numbing and otherwise checking out in this story are the ones who have actually come to the correct conclusion that there's no place for them. There's no place for them in their happiness. There's no sense of meaning or purpose that they can attach to participating in the culture as it's unfolding around them. Some people aren't going to fit well with a story that says, work, consume, keep your mouth shut. Work, consume, keep your mouth shut. Now, those of you who were listening to me recently know that that was the chant that the Yellow Vests came up with last weekend that swept over a number of the marches. Work, consume, keep your mouth shut. You know what? That doesn't work for everybody. And for the people it doesn't work for, your choices include trying to make it work, which is a force fit, or giving up on that. And once you give up on that, our culture basically has no use for you, because our culture is entirely organized around your ability to consume and consume well. If you do a lot of it, boy, we have a lot of support for you. You know, we just tons of wonderful marketing for people who are willing to drop $40,000 on an exotic destination vacation or whatever, right? So, but for people who aren't willing to participate, it's a lot of shaming and marginalization that happens, and a lot of isolation that happens. All right. Continuing on, I love this next part in that paragraph, which says the world loses its credibility and former beliefs and convictions dissolve into doubt, uncertainty, and loss of direction. So if you believed in this idea that your life had meaning and purpose and you just had to figure out how to plug in and you get a job and you do all these things that somehow that gave you the life of meaning and purpose, once your cognitive map breaks down from that, then the world kind of loses its credibility. And boy, this is what, you know, you watch Macron just do everything possible along with the media. Shame on the media. By the way, any of you guys from the media listening to this, you know, if you work at the BBC, the New York Times, Washington Post, you have done horrible job covering the Yellow Vests, and an incredible job of attempting to marginalize them and betray their true causes under a layer of obfuscation and a chance of anti-Semitism and conspiracy ideation and crap like that, right? When what's really happening here is that the leaders who are desperately wanting to keep that whole consumer culture marching forward and their entitled position in it secure, they're desperately afraid of people opening up and beginning to ask these deeper questions, which is around this idea that they've lost their credibility. You know, I think once upon a time, if I met Macron or somebody like him, I would have been a little awed and a little starstruck and got that little ego boost from saying, wow, I met somebody important. And today I might just be looking at a fairly pathetic human being who's just desperately clinging to power against all the better wishes of the future and his own people. It's just pathetic. So that loss of credibility, here's the fun part. When the top people occupying the top positions in a hierarchical society, in a pyramid-shaped society, when they lose their credibility, things go downhill pretty darn quickly after that. So credibility is everything. People are really starting to lose their sense of credibility, especially in the power structures and institutions and things like that. And so he talks about the frustration and anger and bitterness that are the usual accompaniments, as he says, but those are the emotional things that get stirred up when your primary belief system breaks down. The thing that you organized your ego structure around, the thing you organized your sense of identity around, when that gets shaken or broken, That's not a logical process. That's not something you just sit down and map it out, write some pros and cons and go, okay, the pros outweigh the cons, I'll go this way. What happens is emotions, right? So we talk about this in the six stages of awareness, which maps after the five stages of grief, which again is just any time a belief structure is shaken up, that is an emotional process for the person in, or persons involved. It's not a logical process. And this isn't to say that it's not as good as a logical process. I actually happen to believe that both halves of the brain are there for a reason. I happen to ascribe equal weight to both the logical and rational and the emotional and intuitive. Both of those are equally weighted, valid. They each have their roles and places. I think that in our larger story, we've overweighted to this idea that everything needs to be masculine, rational, logical, much to our detriment. We're way out of balance in this larger story. And what has to happen is we need to allow more room for those feminine attributes of stepping into the unknown, of being in the uncertainty and that being okay, of allowing love and peace and unity to have just as much power in our culture as those who would seek domination and, you know, dictation and, you know, making things always follow their particular model of how things should go. That's the Venezuela story playing out. That's played out tons of times. But the point here is that emotional arc of having your belief structures challenged. Well, you know, what did Kubler-Ross say about it? Well, you came out of denial, or we could call that a space where you were unaware, right? I don't think you were in denial necessarily if you didn't know about cancer in your body, and then suddenly it's revealed to you. You were unaware, now you're aware. So you come out of that state, and it could be denial, but fundamentally you come out of that state of unawareness or denial, and then there's anger, right? And then coming out of anger, you would go into bargaining, right? And after bargaining doesn't work, you go into depression. And once you get through all of that and you've processed through it, you get to acceptance. That was her five-stage model, right? So it was denial / lack of awareness into anger, into bargaining, into depression, and into acceptance. Now, you could put a ton of other steps in there if you want. We put a sixth one in there for six stages of awareness. That included fear or anxiety. But he's got other words in here, too. Frustration, anger, bitterness, right? So these are the things that result when your cognitive map breaks down, your belief structure doesn't work. For whatever reason, you know, that's an emotional process. It's how our brains are wired up. You shake that all around, and people come out of that, and then they can move on again. The problem is that with demoralization, it's this the killer thing that he says in that last sentence in that paragraph. Is unlike most forms of depression, demoralization is a realistic response to the circumstances impinging on the person's life. That's what makes this a tricky part. And that's why you need to be prepared to talk about this with people who need to talk about this. This is why it's going to be totally inappropriate for the older generations to simply try and, you know, punish those kids till they go back to school, or to pretend like this doesn't matter, or to give people different happy pills, or to attempt to minimize this, sweep it under the rug, or do anything other than say, hey, wait a minute, your demoralization may well be a realistic response here. Once you can get to that spot, then the freedom begins to reemerge in this story. This is where we can get back to, and I'll just have to put this piece of paper back on top, that Marcus Aurelius quote now comes to the fore. This is my model. I don't believe until you've faced that demoralization, until you've had the opportunity to name it, stare it straight in the face, accept it for what it is, know that there are some things impinging around which they're predicaments. There's nothing we're going to be able to do about them except to decide how we're going to live in response to those conditions. And that's where the freedom comes in, because then you can leave aside all the wasteful, trite frivolities of the consumer culture that's desperately saying, no, Chris, just waste your time, waste it over here, or, you know, numb yourself, right? Because I think Marcus Aurelius had it right. Whatever the circumstances are of the life into which you've been born, whatever the larger impinging circumstances are that may be leading to that sense of demoralization, it is not death that any of us should fear. But we should fear never beginning to live. And that's the part that I think is the freedom that lies on the other side of going into this larger data, looking at everything as that 18-year-old said, oh my God, it's terrible. We now can see across the world as if it was the information itself, like as if that ignorance is bliss was really true. But that's not the case when you're part of an organism that's grown to the edges of its flask and now has some very important decisions to make. Ignorance is not bliss. It's a certified one-way guaranteed trip to oblivion. So we have some really important things to do, and we've got to understand that we're not going to rational our way through them. We are going to have to experience that dark night of the soul, that complete breakdown of our cognitive map, and allow the emotions that are going to accompany that to have their proper due, to exist with us, to not try and fix them, solve them, move through them more quickly, gain deeper understandings from them. Those are all masculine terms, wonderful things to do potentially, but there's a time when those emotional states just need to rise and be part of us because they are part of us. So it's to accept that whatever those emotional terms might be, whether it is anger, depression, acceptance, bargaining, frustration, bitterness, whatever these words are, they're totally appropriate for this time and for those young people who are experiencing these things. Pretending as if they're not is not helping you and it's not helping them. What we need to do is we need to talk about these things and talk about them straight to their experience and the existence of what they're feeling. Knowing that sometimes all we might be able to say is, yeah, raw deal. Sorry, you know, that's just how it's going to be. Nothing we can do about it at this point. So what do we do? What do we do with that? So that's the kind of stuff that's been on my mind over the past few weeks as I've been watching the markets get crammed higher by some desperate central bankers and watching the political landscape get more and more fractured and polarized and watching a lot of thrashing about for solutions where none really exist. And knowing that we're going to go through a bunch of thrashings as people, you know, go through that larger breakdown of our collective cognitive map and know that anybody who's experiencing this on an individual basis is just going through it earlier than other people are going to be going through it. And that's actually a blessing. There are a lot of resources now compared to what we might imagine could be in the future. So, that's really something I wanted to leave you with is, you know, this is what we're going to be talking about in good measure at the seminar, Peak Prosperity Seminar coming up at the end of April out in Sebastopol. This is the kind of topics that I'm really keenly interested in exploring, which is how do we allow this emotional uprising to happen without it demoralizing us into inactivity? How and even more importantly, from a permaculture standpoint, if the problem always contains the solution, what's the solution in here? What is the gift that demoralization is offering? And for me, the gift is freedom. It's freedom. It's freedom to say, you know what? I'm going to leave behind these aspects of this culture that are not working for me, that are militating against my happiness and freedom, that are asking me to do things that I don't want to do, such as fritter away my life and not understand my own power and what my gifts are and all these other things. And to use that freedom then as an opportunity to figure out what your gifts are and what you're going to bring to this world to really achieve significance in this lifetime. And that's really the gift that many of us have been blessed with who are listening to this, is that we have the stability in our lives. And we have the success in our lives to really begin to think about how we begin to knit those together into something we would call significance. And that's a set of ideas that Adam and I came across from somebody Adam met, who we're starting to work more closely with in some ways, Joe Stumpf. He has some great, great ideas on this that map up really beautifully with the eight forms of capital. I'm sure you'll be exposed to some of that for those of you who are coming out to the seminar. If we're lucky, Joe will be there for some of it, just an extraordinary human being and really, really gets this territory very, very well, both from characterizing it and then how you respond to that and how you step into your own significance as a human in the not only in the face of this, but because of this, right? So humans potentially have always been seeking significance through every era of time. And now it matters just a little bit more because of that message that we carry at Peak Prosperity, which says, yeah, it's always true that we want to make the most of ourselves. And look where we are in this larger world story. It's really time for us to step up. So that's it. That's what I've got for you. I hope you enjoyed listening to this. It's time, everybody. And this is Chris Martinson signing off. I will see you, talk to you next time. Bye-bye.